School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. The East African nation of Ethiopia has spent much of the last three decades as an authoritarian, one-party state. Political opponents of the ruling Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front were regularly jailed. Independent journalists could be beaten, exiled, or charged with terrorism. Companies owned by the Ethiopian government or ruling party control much of the economy, and since 2001, the country has been in a tense military standoff with neighboring Eritrea following a two-year border war. But earlier this year, a new prime minister took power in Africa's second most populous nation, and he set about making some big changes. Abiy Ahmed is just 42 years old. He's often compared by Ethiopians to Barack Obama for his youthful looks and energetic speeches. One thing that's notable about Ahmed is that he's an ethnic Oromo. Now, that's the largest group in Ethiopia, but one that has long been marginalized politically by ethnic Tigrayans and Amharas who have traditionally run the country. Now, also important is the fact that shortly after Ahmed took office, he released hundreds of political prisoners, including many charged under a sweeping anti-terrorism law. He's even made overtures to Ethiopia's archenemy, Eritrea. So on this edition of Global Journalist, a look at Ethiopia's new prime minister and his efforts to open one of Africa's most repressive states. We've got some great guests to tell us more about that. Joining us from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, is Paul Shem. He's a foreign editor for The Washington Post, who lives in Ethiopia. Also with us in Washington, D.C. is Soliana Shemelis. She's a policy analyst at the Ethiopian Human Rights Project. Back in 2012, she co-founded the Zone 9 blogging collective in Ethiopia to advocate for human rights. And in 2014, a number of her colleagues in the effort were imprisoned. And also on the line from Ottawa, Ontario, is Felix Horn. He's the senior Ethiopia and Eritrea researcher for Human Rights Watch. Welcome to all of you. Paul Shem, let me start with you. Give us just a little bit of background about how Ethiopia has been run for the last 20 years. I think that's kind of important for us to understand before we get into talking about some of these big changes that have been taking place.
Sure. It really goes back to 1991 when the rebels overthrew a communist-led dictatorship. And the group that led the rebels was the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front. And they set up the system that came afterwards under the then Prime Minister Meles Zenawi. And the Tigrayans took a very powerful role in all this. And they set up something called ethnic federalism, where each region was basically run by a party that was part of their coalition, the EPRDF. And they ran their affairs, but really the Tigrayans were in charge. So you had an Oromo region, you know, the Amhara region, and then the various others. And that continued on. And under the idea of democratic centralism, very much influenced by Lenin and other things, everyone voted together in the same way. And, you know, this was, and Meles directed things. And this continued on. They held elections in 2005, which they then lost in many areas. And that resulted in a lot of riots and a lot of deaths on the street. And after that, things took a much more authoritarian cant. And they also started cracking down on the press, but they also pushed forward with a lot of economic growth. The idea was to sort of grow the economy out of the unrest. That was the case for many years until starting in really 2014 and especially 2015, you had the Oromo region started protesting. In the beginning, it was more bread and butter issues. It was land was being taken away, confiscated for various projects. But also when you started talking to people, and I did a few trips into the countryside, and people were like, well, the local administrators from the local Oromo government party are really corrupt. And this kind of, you know, this went on and on. So it went from, you know, we're mad about the Addis Master Plan to we're mad about the government. And that was a problem for the government. You know, they suppressed the protests. People were killed. A lot of this ended up on social media, in part spread by people who lived abroad. And then, of course, the government started doing things like cutting the internet. But, you know, the protests continued. And what was key was then the Amhara joined. And now you had the two largest ethnic groups essentially protesting against the government. And this is the point where suddenly you realize the Tigrayans are only 6% of the population, and they've had this very dominant position. But the other parts of their party, the Oromo and the Amhara part, were opposing them. And I think it was at this point where you had widespread unrest. You started having splits in this ruling coalition that set up stage for this massive change that's happened. I mean, myself, I've only been in Ethiopia for 3 years now, but I've certainly talked to people and to my friends here, and they say the scale of change right now is moving at light speed. And for a country that seemed quite stagnant, at least on a political aspect, for so long, this is quite impressive.
Well, let me turn this to you then, Soliana Shimelis, because I think this sets the stage for Abiy Ahmed's ascendancy here. Talk to us about who he is and how he became prime minister, because he had been a longtime member of this ruling party, but from sort of the Oromo branch, which had never really had significant power previously.
Yes, that's right. Abiy Ahmed has been a member of EPRD for the last 20 years. Since he was a teenager, he joined EPRD. He joined EPRD. Then he was a member of the Oromo party within the coalition. He had served in different places, including the Oromia region, and then after in the federal government, he was a state minister for some in some of federal government positions. And I think one of the first time that he was becoming visible was at a time when in the middle of the protests, the previous prime minister, Hailemariam Desalegn, was pushed to change his cabinet and to show some reforms that they're responding to the protesters. And then he changed his cabinet and he brought new minister members. And Abiy Ahmed was one of them. He was a minister of technology. And then people had also noticed him, especially journalists noticed that he had been very energetic and gives different comments in the parliament. So, and then after the change was in... within the party, the Oromo coalition changed its leadership due to the protest, and in that leadership he happens to be the vice president of the region and also the deputy chairperson of this Oromo coalition party within the EPRD.
So the ruling party in effect sort of promoted him through the ranks, in part it sounds like in the hopes that having someone like him, a young, dynamic, ethnic Oromo within the government in a senior position in the government would sort of help to quell some of the unrest, particularly in this Oromia region.
Yeah, that's true. He has been a part of the regional administration after he served in federal places. But after the protests keep going and the new prime minister put his resignation, and one of the things that the ruling coalition started to discuss was like the protests are going on in Oromia region, so there's an importance and there's a need to have a Oromo prime minister to bring him to the federal government. So that's what happened, and then there had been a lot of resistances within the party. There had been a lot of back and forth, and there has been a lot of like uncertainties about his being prime minister, and finally they decided to make him a chair of the party, which automatically makes him a prime minister of the country.
Well, Felix Horn, let me turn this to you then, because you have been following human rights in Ethiopia for some time. It has been one of the most repressive countries in Africa. So give us just an idea of the scope of the changes that the new prime minister has, you know, sort of talked about or initiated over the last 3 months.
Yeah, I mean, for years, we've seen almost no change, or no positive change, I should say, in Ethiopia's human rights landscape. So the pace of change has been incredible, as Paul touched on. I mean, I think the biggest thing is, you know, the release of significant amounts of political prisoners. I mean, there's been various political prisoners that groups like Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, and national groups have been advocating for over the years. Virtually all of them have been released. That's not to say there are not still political prisoners. There are, but all of the high-profile ones have left. The prime minister has also made overtures to opposition parties. You know, we have elections that are planned for 2020, so it's important that a sort of fair, open political landscape is created before those elections, so that we don't get a repeat of a government that is unpopular in many areas receiving 100% of the seats across the country. There's also been.
And sorry, we should say this is what two previous Ethiopian elections resulted in the ruling party winning something like 90, 95, 99% of the seats in parliament.
Yeah, exactly. And then in 2015, they won 100% of the seats. You know, there's also been lots of promises of reform, you know, which is very positive. There's been talk of amending the anti-terrorism law, the Charities and Societies Proclamation, which restricts NGOs from operating inside of Ethiopia. So a lot of really positive things in a very short period of time. You know, obviously, there's been increased overtures between Ethiopia and Eritrea, which is critical in so many ways. It's also critical for human rights inside of Eritrea, which is another issue that it doesn't get enough attention in Dr. Abiy's various speeches. So I think there's a lot of hope, a lot of optimism. I mean, opposition politicians, activists who had almost nothing good to ever say about the government have very much come on board with this sort of Dr. Abiy revolution. So it's very positive. I think a key question for us is how long can he sustain this, given that there are some within the ruling coalition that are clearly not on side with these reforms. And there are a lot of issues sort of bubbling beneath the surface across the country, which need his attention before they get completely out of hand.
Paul Shem, if I could turn this back to you, then we heard Felix talking about sort of the scope and the scale of some of these changes. I think it's important to note that there was actually a huge rally in support of the prime minister in Addis Ababa just a few days ago. Tell us why that took place and what happened.
Well, it was probably the biggest rally of its kind in Ethiopia's modern history. I mean, estimates kind of vary. It's hard to say, but judging by the area occupied, some say about 500,000 people. Of course, there's people saying even more, which considering the population of the city is about 4 million, is really quite staggering. So it was there basically to provide support for the prime minister. And it was this idea that with all these reforms moving so quickly, he had to show, or people felt the need to show that, we are behind him. I don't really think that was ever much in doubt. I mean, frankly, his reception has been quite rapturous, but there have been fears that perhaps there's this deep state that's going to stop him. There's this, remnants of the TPLF, though I don't know how, powerful they are at this point. So there was this rally, and it was an incredibly joyous occasion. People were cheering, they were singing songs, there were parades all over the city leading up to this main square. After he finished speaking and he'd sat down, someone chucked a hand grenade. Now, it seems as though they were stopped by other people in the crowd from actually getting it to the podium, but it did explode. And then it caused a stampede in that area. And about 150 people were wounded and 2 people died of their injuries. It was a terrible way for such an occasion to end. And it was quite frustrating. Though I would say probably most of the people in the square didn't know that happened, because it was such a vast area and people on the edges probably, some people thought it was a firework. They were like calling for more and more, but, obviously in the area around it, there was a lot of fear. There was a lot of people running. But Abiy Ahmed was safe. He was on TV a second later, He was on TV maybe 10, 15 minutes later, basically saying that he was okay. He would not let this stop him, and then love would prevail. And it's actually very interesting how much he uses the phrase love and unity in his speeches. I think he's very aware that Ethiopia is at an incredibly tenuous point right now in its ethnic makeup. I mean, there's about 80 different ethnic groups in this country, maybe 7 or 8 main ones. And in some places, they're at each other's throats, it's not just, Oromo versus Amhara versus Tigrayan, they're smaller groups. So I think he wants to be out there, present this Ethiopian unity message that we can all get along. And I think right now that's quite important for the country.
Well, Soliana Shimelis, one of the things that he's done that is striking in its departure from where Ethiopia had been previously was that he's been very critical of the government's own human rights record. As Felix suggested, he's talked about repealing this counterterrorism law that was basically used as a way to jail political opponents. I mean, he's even talked about the government's use of torture in jail, its mistreatment of people. He's talking about some very sensitive subjects that the ruling party itself was involved with for years and years and years and years. I mean, how easy is it going to be for him to carry out all these changes when you have this large security and military apparatus that is totally implicated in all these abuses?
That's actually very interesting. One of the two things, as Paul said, the one is like the political rhetoric is completely changed from what EPRDFers usually say and do, which includes the prime minister admitting that the government had been conducting torture in the middle of his parliament speech, question and answer, which is a surprise by itself because the government has never admitted for such kind of like torture and inhuman treatment and detentions. And he even said that we had been using this to stay in power, and that's our side of terrorism. So in general, like the rhetoric has changed, starting from love, unity, and so on, and then telling the public to refrain from conflict, but at the same time also acting almost as an opposition prime minister, who's also, who's basically a member of the ruling party itself. There are challenges. I mean, the first challenge would be obviously the security, and the military is not clear yet, and there had been an immense challenge from that. There are a lot of hardliners with the security and the military who are not really comfortable with this change. That's what we hear. So basically, it will be very difficult to implement this change while you have this kind of political structure, which is mainly engaged in issues like torture, prison administration, and also somehow in managing some forms of the justice.
I mean, it strikes me that he risks that there will be a coup attempt against him when you come in and move this quickly against sort of the military and security forces.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that one of the fear from policy analysts and people who follow the Ethiopia case closely is that like there might be a lot of challenges and that might even make him lose his power. But I guess he had been thinking about this, and he thought like maybe moving this quickly before the EPR, the ruling party Congress in August would be much better. But the other challenge would be, even though Zohivi wants to do this, even though he doesn't have any limitation from the hardliner side, obviously there's going to be a challenge with like the civil service, the capacity of like the government structure, which doesn't have a professional people so far because they had been assigned by loyalty to the ruling party and so on. So in addition to these political challenges, he was also going to have like a civil service and professional challenge.
Well, Felix Horn, you had been talking about his overtures to Eritrea, which of course fought a bloody border war with Ethiopia. Tens of thousands of people were killed from 1998 to 2000 in that war. And then there's been sort of like this frozen Cold War ever since between the two countries, and one of the first things that Abiy Ahmed came in and has done is that he has reached out to Eritrea, and you've said that could have some pretty significant implications for East Africa as a whole.
Yeah, no, it definitely will. I mean, there's lots of obvious implications in terms of access to ports, economic trade between the countries. Eritrea has often been accused of supplying support, weapons, various forms of training to the different Ethiopian armed opposition groups. So that would likely cease to happen. Similarly, Ethiopia provides support to Eritrea's armed opposition groups. So I think there's a lot of advantages that could come from peace between the two countries. One of the things that President Isaias in Eritrea has often said is that the reason why people are conscripted into the army indefinitely, which means in practice for their lives, is because of this situation with Ethiopia, this no peace, no war situation. So if peace all of a sudden comes, then his primary excuse for that indefinite conscription disappears too. So there's lots of potential implications, most of which are positive, but obviously there's lots of issues around the border areas, people that are on both sides of the borders who have lived there for a very long time. And we've seen some noises that the TPLF, the Tigrayan People Liberation Front, have not been completely on board with this increased partnership with Eritrea. So we'll have to see how that unfolds over time. But overall, yeah, it's a very positive step for the two countries to come closer together.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about the rapid reforms in Ethiopia taking place after decades of authoritarian rule. We're joined by Paul Shem of The Washington Post, Soliana Shimelis of the Ethiopian Human Rights Project, and Felix Horn of Human Rights Watch. If you're interested in more Global Journalists, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find our archives and additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues. You can also like us on Facebook, where we live stream, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, or see our videocast on YouTube. And Paul Shem, you are in Addis Ababa. Ethiopia has gotten a lot of good press in recent years for its rapid economic growth rate. It's sort of, I think, oftentimes been compared with China, and that it's sort of an authoritarian place where the government, the ruling party, has kind of used economic growth as sort of their main reason or rationale for staying in power there. That doesn't seem to have been enough now to keep popular support for the ruling party. Talk to us just a little bit about how things look from an economic perspective.
Yeah, I think the old EPRDF that was in charge a year ago would have loved this comparison to China, because that was really their model. You know, it's a fairly authoritarian state with lots of state-led investment, and we're going to grow the economy by building lots of stuff with infrastructure, which is great. The country needs infrastructure, but the private sector was still fairly throttled. It was difficult to start a business. It was difficult to get loans and other things. The result was that jobs weren't being created. So you had all these projects and, of course, a great deal of loans and a great deal of debt building up for it. But ultimately, it wasn't transforming the economy. And what Abe has done right from the beginning is said that he wants to do something different. He's got up before Parliament and said, we want a market-driven economy. We are going to sell shares in some of the major state-owned enterprises. We are going to entirely privatize other parts of the economy, which was a huge departure. They'll probably keep a state stake in things like the airlines and the telecom. But he really does want to open it up. And I think it's his recognition that while we've had these high growth rates, the growth really has not trickled down. I mean, there's a lovely railroad here. There's a light rail there. There's these massive dams they're building. But the result has not been major amounts of job, because I think it's all state led, is my feeling. And you don't have this sort of organic middle class that is really pushing things forward. To go back to something we said earlier, and I know this is sort of, we're in the economic section right now, you talked about fears of a coup and everything, but you have to remember now, before there was unrest. Now, can you imagine if there was a coup against this incredibly popular prime minister who hails from the Oromo region and actually has a constituency of just 35 million people from his ethnic group? I think removing him would be incredibly dangerous for some shadowy cabal of generals or whoever. And I think that is quite a key point to remember. His predecessor was from a small ethnic group in the South and didn't really have a constituency. What everyone agrees now is that Abe has support and has backing. So gone are the days when a backroom deal can change a puppet prime minister in this country.
Well, so Liana Shimelis, we heard Paul talking about some of the ethnic dimensions of this earlier. How do you see things? What has Abe been doing to try to ease some of the tensions between the Oromo and other ethnic groups, and even some of these other smaller groups that may be at each other's throats over local issues?
The first thing that he has done before even becoming a prime minister is the part of the Oromo fraction from the ruling coalition tried to establish some form of coalition with the Amhara fraction within the APRDF itself. And then it has been only 7 months that they had a kind of like a public diplomacy visit from Oromo region to Amhara region, kind of trying to show solidarity to each other as at the people level and also within the party, at each other's fraction level. And then that has been done while Abe was a deputy regional administrator for Oromo region. So it looks like they started this form of the coalition in showing solidarity between ethnic groups while they were in the region. And after he got the federal power in the prime ministership, he had been mentioning in almost his speech that the public should refrain from conflict, and then the solidarity should keep on. And then he also kind of like wrote this rhetoric that Ethiopia was great, and then bringing the Ethiopian greatness and togetherness back, which is normally not a rhetoric that's expected from that Oromo fraction, because usually that fraction is known for saying that Oromo marginalization within the Ethiopian state is one of the rallying rhetoric of this Oromo fraction now. So that rhetoric is also changed, and then they came to the center and they showed solidarity, and then they created some form of coalition with the Amhara region. And then building up on that, he's now calling for refraining from conflicts. In one of his speech, including the last one in the rally at Maskal Square, he gave emphasis on like not taking any mob justice action, not refraining from conflict in different parts of the country. And also there had been this tension because TPLF is now being taken as a party who takes the blame for what happens in the last 27 years. So he had been warning the people that like there's a difference between TPLF, the party, the Tigrayan fraction of the party, and then the Tigrayan public in the northern. So I think he had been using this rhetoric.
So he's been trying to diminish some of the anti-Tigrayan sentiment that may exist among some of the other ethnic groups, because I know that had been a fear or at least used as an excuse by the ruling party for a long time, was that there might be this sentiment that could explode into ethnic violence. They'd even compared it to genocide in Rwanda.
But there hadn't been any policy measures, There hadn't been clear policy measures except the rhetoric.
Well, Felix Horn, let me turn this to you then, because we had been talking about these issues of ethnic division. There has also been, as we mentioned, thousands of political prisoners in Ethiopia's jails in recent years. Security forces have shot unarmed protesters. Many, many violations of human rights abuses. Has there been any discussion of how there might be some reconciliation or accountability for those who are involved in those?
I mean, that's certainly something that's been lacking from his many speeches. He's really avoided talking about security force abuse at all until his important speech in Parliament, where he acknowledged that torture happened. But there's been very little about accountability. And although there's been a lot of changes in the security forces at the top, you know, a number of key generals have been replaced in the military, for example, there are still a lot of individuals who are implicated in abuse over the last few years in Oromia and Amhara and elsewhere, who are still in their positions. And so, yeah, accountability is something that is very important, that needs to be dealt with. In the eastern part of the country, along the border of the Oromia region and the Somali region, we have a very abusive police force called the Leo Police, who have been implicated in very serious crimes for many years. They're part of the Somali region security apparatus. You know, he hasn't...
So it's sort of nominally part of the government, but sort of a quasi-militia as well, then.
Exactly, and it reports to the president of the Somali region, and they've been implicated in some very serious crimes. And there's been lots of talk about reform of that police force, holding key individuals to account, but for now they continue to carry out daily killings in that area. So there's a lot of things around security force reform, accountability, that hasn't really been tackled yet, or at least there's no evidence that it's been tackled. But admittedly, this is going to be one of the toughest things that Dr. Abiy has to do because of the strength of the military and some of the things that we've been talking about today. So accountability needs to be front and foremost on his agenda to ensure that these type of abuses we've talked about for many years don't happen into the near future.
Well, Paul Shem, if I could get you to look into your crystal ball. Ethiopia does have national elections coming up in a couple years. The ruling party has been sort of the elephant at these elections for a long time. The opposition parties within the country have been like mice in comparison. Are we going to see competitive elections going forward, or is the ruling party, in spite of these changes, still going to be sort of the dominant force?
Well, the extremely popular prime minister is still a member of the ruling party. So there's that. It's kind of hard to see how he could run in any election and not do extremely well. I mean, a lot of the important opposition parties have been in the Oromo region, the OFC, the groups allied to the OLF. But right now, I think most Oromos would vote for Abiy's party. You know, so the question is, will we still have an EPRDF, this grand coalition of these ruling parties, when we move into the elections, or will they start splitting off? Right now, I don't see a truly national party, so I'm not sure what will happen in the coming elections. I think it's hard to see, just because the whole system is built around this elephant party and then these sort of tiny opposition parties. But right now, you know, the guy running the show is very popular, so he would probably win an election if he stayed with this ruling party, unless they decide to kind of divide things up. I mean, it is important that he said, we want the opposition there. We see you as competition, but not as, you know, not as enemies. And I think that's quite key. The other thing that, looking into my crystal ball, that I would worry about is what we've been bringing up until now, is some of these ethnic clashes. So in some cases, they've dropped, but in many cases, they're on the rise. I mean, there's been terrible killings in the south and also in the west of the country that just happened in the last few days. We're talking about maybe a dozen people killed here, a dozen there, and it's, you know, the one ethnic minority attacking another, often people who were settlers there who came from outside. And I think there is a settling of scores. There is a feeling that the situation is opening up, so it's time to really go after some of those groups that you've long resented. And I think this is a massive challenge for Abiy. One thing he's done that's been quite interesting is he said,
We're just out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute of the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Paul Shem, Soliana Shimelis, and Felix Horn. Our producer this week is Idom Kasaye, Aaron Hay is audio engineer, and Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.